This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Now, here's Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm superstar Frank Morano, and we are moments away from telling you about some people or entities that have done something that is disreputable, and you're about to hear from them. Elias, I know you got a lot going on today because you are doing double duty for Matt Blaze and so forth. Should I assume that the stack of articles that normally accompany denunciations have not and will not be printed? Is that a fair assumption on my part?
They're right outside. They're for you.
Oh, they're printed already. They're printed? They were printed? Well, it's not a trick question. Were they printed?
Yeah.
Oh, they're printed.
Yeah.
Somebody could have let me know.
I usually don't let you know, but you usually find them.
All right, well.
You have a nose for this stuff.
There you go. I see that. Well, if you wouldn't mind or having a representative bring them to me,
I would
certainly appreciate that. Thank you. I didn't mean to question the alacrity with which you're printing these articles. In the meantime.
The Other Side of Midnight presents Denunciations.
Let me begin by denouncing the person or persons, but it looks like it's a person, who lit a fire outside of Bernie Sanders' office. This is just terrible. They started a fire outside Senator Bernie Sanders' Vermont office a week ago, and apparently the fellow that did this, Shant Michael Sogomanian, has had many past brushes with the law. Color me is not surprised. And the security video very clearly shows Mr. Sogomanian throwing liquid at the bottom of a door opening into Sanders' third floor office in Burlington and setting it on fire with a lighter last Friday. This is awful. This is a 35-year-old man. Why people feel the need to set anything on fire is beyond me, but when it comes to the situation of vandalism of political figures, especially in a manner that could really hurt people, I think this is totally inexcusable. So, Shant Michael Sogomanian, I do denounce you. I must also denounce Ecuador, more specifically the government of Ecuador. What they did last week was really inexcusable. Ecuadorian authorities forced their way into a diplomatic mission to arrest Ecuador's former vice president, Jorge Glass, who's been holed up there seeking asylum in Mexico. And this is just terrible. This is a violation of every diplomatic concept that we hold dear. This is a violation of respect for things like diplomatic missions. And the Mexican president is pretty ticked off. At a news conference in Mexico City, he railed against Ecuador and said that they should be suspended in accordance with the UN Charter. I'll be honest with you, I agree with them. There's no excuse for having the police raid an embassy in order to get one of your people. And these two countries have been tussling over Mr. Glass, who's a convicted criminal and fugitive, since he took refuge at Mexico's embassy. Well, that's what diplomacy is all about. Negotiation, diplomacy, discussion. It's not raiding an embassy, which is supposed to be like it's actually an extension of that country. So, Ecuador, I do denounce you. I also want to denounce the driver of the truck that blocked me as I was trying to leave the radio station on Tuesday. This so ticked me off. I got the guy's license plate. I may report him. But this is a big tractor trailer for White Plains Linen. It's for Linens a la Carte. You can check out. It's a wholesale chef store. And this guy with the license plate, New York license plate 95578ND, blocked me in. And I wasn't able to leave for about 20 to 30 minutes. Now, keep in mind, this was a day where I was already exhausted because I give you people my heart and soul each and every day. And I just wanted to go home and go to sleep for a few hours before I had to take care of my sick son. And instead, I am blocked in. The car, I can't get out because there's a car parked in front of me. And I can't get out to the right. Looking around for a driver, no driver. I go in to Omar, the door guy. Hey, Omar, do you know whose car that is? Nope. Do you know who's that boy? Nope. Haven't seen him. I mean, it's so disrespectful just to block people in like that. I don't like that at all. So to the driver of that particular vehicle and to this business, White Plains Linen, Linens a la Carte, that would hire a driver like that, I do denounce you. I also want to denounce the person who pushed a woman down the stairs at a Queen's church. It happened Sunday morning in Jamaica, in New York. This 68-year-old woman is walking up the stairs to the church's entrance when the suspect runs up the stairs in front of her. And he punches her in the face, causing her to fall backwards down the stairs and into the sidewalk. And this class act that did it grabbed the woman's bag, checked her pockets, and ran off. The woman had $300, a cell phone, a credit card, and car keys in her bag. And they've made an arrest. The police have made an arrest. It turns out it's a 16-year-old boy that did this. He's been charged with robbery, assault, grand larceny, and criminal possession of stolen property. His name's not being released at this time because he is a juvenile. Well, I'm sure his parents are really proud of him. Pushing a woman, punching a woman, and robbing her at church on a Sunday. Sheesh. I want to denounce the person who stabbed a prominent dissident Iranian TV presenter, and they really went out of their way to be dishonest. Do you know how this stabber got to stab this Iranian dissident? He got through security with a bogus interview request. And the attacker posed as a journalist from the Jerusalem Post, all to lure this prominent dissident by the name of Puaria Zarati into a trap. And this really does highlight the lengths that adversaries will go to in order to target vocal critics of the Iranian regime. And here you have this man who is a key figure on the anti-Iranian regime channel, Iran International. He recounted exactly what happened to him, and thankfully he's feeling better, but he could have died. He could have died. And I am denouncing the stabber not only for stabbing this person, but for masquerading as a journalist. Now it makes it more difficult for the next person to get an interview request. I want to denounce the conservative operatives who made misleading robocalls in the 2020 election. Jacob Wall and Jack Berkman have agreed to pay $1.2 million to the Attorney General's office for a robocall campaign they put together to suppress the black vote ahead of the 2020 election. Apparently, they orchestrated a disinformation campaign to intimidate black voters. And they would basically, the speaker on the robocall would identify herself as Tamika Taylor of Project 1599 and falsely claimed that voting by mail would result in voters having their personal information used by the police to track old warrants and allow credit card companies to collect debts and the CDC to track people for mandatory vaccinations. The robocall would say, "Don't be finessed into giving your private information to the man. Stay home safe and beware of vote by mail." You know, I'm all for free speech, but outright lying and doing this kind of a disinformation campaign, I guess it's protected speech by the First Amendment, but you shouldn't do it. You shouldn't do it. It's bad. If your candidate is the right candidate, try to convince people based on the merits, not fooling them into not voting because, you know, you've tricked them. I think it's really reprehensible. I want to denounce Dr. Louis Bourget. Dr. Bourget is an oral surgeon, and he has received an absolute discharge after he guided a correction officer at a prison through the removal of a sedated inmate's teeth. Dr. Bourget is an oral surgeon who will not have a criminal record, but he was charged with assault after he permitted a correctional officer to extract an inmate's teeth in October of 2020. The incident was recorded by another correctional officer on his phone. Here's a tip, by the way. If you're going to do something you shouldn't be doing, whatever it is, don't record it. That's my advice to everybody that's going to extract inmates' teeth when they're not oral surgeons. So Bourget operates out of the Gander Family Dental Clinic building, and he's been discharged. It's the lowest level of a criminal sentence that an adult offender can have. And two correction officers from the Bishop's Falls Correctional Center, Ron McDonald and Roy Goodyear, accompanied an inmate to the clinic. And basically, while this patient was sedated, Bourget was explaining the procedure to the guards, and he then suggested one of the guards remove four teeth. How'd you like to be that inmate? McDonald took out the teeth while Goodyear recorded the whole thing. Bourget said he got caught up in a teaching moment, but regretted the decision after the procedure. Now, if you're going to the dentist in a prison, would you ever feel comfortable ever again? I mean, this is just awful, awful. So I totally denounce Dr. Louis Bourget. I also want to denounce the U.S. Navy. The U.S. Navy is being appropriately mocked for posting a photo online of a sailor shooting a rifle. Nothing wrong with that. But they're shooting it with a back-to-front scope, meaning the area of the scope that you look into is incorrect. So the Navy's official Instagram page issued a photo of Commander Cameron Yeast, the captain of the guided missile destroyer USS John S. McCain, shooting a rifle with a backwards-mounted scope. The image, also sent as an official press release, was captioned, "From engaging in practice gun shoots, conducting maintenance, testing fuel purity, and participating in sea and anchor details, the U.S. Navy is always ready to serve and protect." Well, social media users and other branches of the U.S. military quickly mocked the image, in which Commander Yeast was also using a scope with the lens cap attached. So the scope was not just backwards, but the lens cap was attached. The U.S. Marines posted a separate image of a Marine holding and firing a rifle correctly, and they appeared to poke fun at the Navy by posting a similar image to their Instagram account, but with the rifle correctly held and fired. One user on Twitter joked, "We're going to lose a major war." Another said simply, "Dear U.S. Navy, the scope is on backwards. This is why we have Marines on ships." U.S. Navy, I do denounce you. I want to denounce Danielle Johnson, and I got nervous because I thought this was my friend Danielle Johnson, but apparently it's not. This is a separate Danielle Johnson than the one I'm acquainted with. A mother stabbed her partner to death before pushing her two daughters out of a moving car, killing an 8-year-old baby. She is an astrology influencer who was apparently stressed out about this week's eclipse. Perhaps I should be denouncing the eclipse, but Danielle Johnson is known online as Danielle Ayoka. And she apparently also died in the tragic series of events after crashing her car on the Pacific Coast Highway. After abandoning her daughters, minutes after abandoning her daughters, Johnson, identified by police sources to the LA Times, described the eclipse as the epitome of spiritual warfare in the days leading up to the murders, warning followers to pick a side in posts on Twitter. Her profile was also filled with all sorts of anti-Semitic posts and COVID conspiracy theories. Days later, on the morning of the eclipse, the family was dead, with investigators finding tarot cards and black feathers in her apartment. So the police haven't spoken publicly about this, but sources told the LA Times that cops believed her erratic postings surrounding the eclipse may point to the cause. So I hate to denounce someone that's dead, but I'm making an exception in this case. And finally, I want to denounce Jesse Kipf, K-I-P-F. Maybe it's Kip, but I'm assuming it's Kipf. Jesse Kipf is a Southern Kentucky man who admitted to faking his death to avoid paying child support. Now, I have very little respect for deadbeat dads in the first place. But, okay, sometimes maybe you don't have any money. I would think you'd earn some money to support your children, but okay. But if you're actually going to go to the lengths of faking your own death to avoid paying child support, that is, in my view, just evil. So he pled guilty to computer fraud and aggravated identity theft. Apparently, he used a computer to access Hawaii's death registry system, where he created a fake death certificate for himself. His plea document says he did this to avoid paying child support fees of more than $100,000. He also hacked other government and business networks to steal credentials. He was initially charged with multiple counts of computer fraud and identity theft, but thanks to his plea deal, he was able to drop many of them. Now he owes over $200,000 to the various agencies he has wronged. Jesse Kipf, I do denounce you. All right. We're going to talk with Celia Farber in about 10 minutes about O.J. Simpson. A lot has been said about O.J. in the last 24 hours. Much of it has been focused on his time as an athlete, as an actor, and as a celebrity before he went on trial for murder. Much of it has been focused on the time that he was on trial for murder. But we're going to talk with Celia Farber in about 5 minutes, who got to know OJ after that. What's it like to know OJ Simpson after he's acquitted of a double murder and found liable for that same killing? We're going to talk to her in a bit. But first, let me say a quick hello to Max in Las Vegas. Hey there, Max.
I am so grateful. Have you seen Oliver Stone's movie Talk Radio?
Have I seen Oliver Stone's movie Talk Radio? It is one of my favorite movies of all time.
And a lot of people don't realize it's based off of a true story. But you're just knocking it out of the park. And I got to talk to Senator Huckabee at the time, and he had a top-notch national radio show like you. And I said, how do you beat 25 hours? He said, try 50. The 25 hours was the 3 hours a day on the air. And boom, and your listeners don't know what you go into preparation to to put out this product that you do.
I appreciate that, Max. And I think that was Governor Huckabee as well, who whose daughter is now a governor in Arkansas. Max, thank you. I appreciate the call and the compliment and any opportunity to talk about talk radio, which, as far as I'm concerned, is a great picture. And I love the log line in that movie where it refers to talk radio as America's last neighborhood. Celia Farber joins me straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. A lot of people talking about OJ, and about 900 people have referenced either in person, on this radio show, on the phone, in text, on social media, one of the most iconic moments of the whole OJ Simpson saga, which was the white Ford Bronco chase. You remember it. It was while the Knicks were in the playoffs, big playoff games. I think they were playing the Houston Rockets. I, who was even a casual basketball fan back then, was really into it. And then all of a sudden, the world was riveted, not by the basketball game, but by this slow speed chase where you had Al Cowlings and O.J. Simpson being pursued by the police in this white Ford Bronco. You ever wonder what became of that white Ford Bronco? Well, there was a fascinating article about it in The Observer written about 8 years ago, and it happened to be written by someone that I'm very close to and someone whose father was a radio legend. Now, I didn't know that when I started watching the ESPN 30 for 30 documentary about O.J. Simpson, which won Best Picture at the Academy Awards a few years ago. And imagine my surprise as I'm watching this and I just hear the most interesting, captivating story ever about O.J. Simpson as told by Celia Farber. I'm very, very pleased to welcome Celia Farber to the program. She's a veteran investigative journalist. She also writes a popular Substack called The Truth Barrier, which you can check out at celiafarber.substack.com. And she's author of a book called Serious Adverse Events, An Uncensored History of AIDS. Celia, it's great to talk with you. Thanks for getting up early with us.
Oh, great to be with you, Frank. It's been a long time. How are you?
I'm doing wonderfully, and we are overdue for a get together. That's for sure.
So, yes, we are.
Celia, in that documentary, which some of our audience may have seen, many of them may have not, you talk about your interactions with OJ, which I want to ask you about. But first, how did you come to interact with OJ in person? Was it in your pursuit of this article about the white Ford Bronco?
No, it was way before that article. The whole thing began in 1997. I got a call from my then agent, and she said, Esquire called and called me back. I'll tell you what it is. You're not going to want to do it, but I'll tell you what it is. I called her back. She said, they want you to go to Los Angeles and do a story about O.J. Simpson's post-trial life as a pariah. And I said, Bonnie, why wouldn't I want to do that? Of course I'll do it. And I got the assignment. And when I got the assignment, none of us really thought I would meet him and talk to him. That wasn't even necessarily what the assignment hinged upon. It was back in the day when there were these sort of conceptual long form articles that, you know, one would get assigned to do. And the idea was collect little bits and pieces from anybody who will talk to you about OJ as a pariah in Brentwood, whether it's the ice cream salesman or the golf course people. But of course I was to make a good effort to try to talk to him. So I did what is known as an old fashioned stakeout. I stayed outside Rockingham. I was there every day, like, you know, I don't know, 8-10 hours a day. And I just hung out, and I got to know his bodyguard, a guy named Tom, told me a lot. And he eventually came to trust me, and he decided to help me out. And one day he said, so we would see OJ come in and out of the gate. We would see all the tourists, clamor around and try to get autographs. And I was there. I put letters under the door. My name is such and such. I'm from Esquire. Would you possibly talk to me? I'm going to be fair, you know, et cetera. And got no response. And then one evening, Tom said, ask him where he's going to tee off. And I said to him, OJ, my name is Celia Farber. I've been putting these letters under the gate for you. And I have a 2.5-year-old son at home in New York, and I can't go home until you talk to me. And he turned around and he said, I can relate to that, because when I was incarcerated, I remember he said incarcerated, I really missed my kids. And he told me where he was going to be playing golf the next day. So I went. And we did an interview there at the golf course. It was a way, I would say, shabbier golf course than what he had been used to in his, you know, in his day. That was exactly what my story was about. All the golf courses that wouldn't have him anymore, all the restaurants where he was banned, all this kind of stuff. So we did this interview, and it was OJ talking a blue streak, starting nowhere, ending nowhere, kind of just rambling wildly about everything and a lot, you know, memories about Nicole, but he didn't really answer questions. He didn't really focus. So even though I got him to talk to me, I came back to New York feeling very, what am I going to do with all this? How am I going to build a piece around this? And lo and behold, he called me in New York shortly after I got back. And this is where everything turned around. He said, hey, it's OJ. I don't know why, but no, he said, hey, it's OJ. I'm not done talking to you. I don't know why, but I talk to you like you're my shrink or something. And then he said, swear to God, let's say I killed her. if I did it, it would had to have been because I loved her very much, right? And I don't have a tape recorder, nothing. I remember being frantic for a pen or a pencil, anything I could write with. Found a pencil, wrote down the quote verbatim, and I had this feeling like, oh no, you know, this is going to be nuts. And as I wrote in a piece that I posted on my Substack today, maybe a more normal journalistic competitive response would be, you know, there's my scoop. This is amazing. But I just felt this dread because I knew that what he had said was going to send everything into just a wild circus. And I knew that I wasn't really cut out for that. You know, I wasn't even an OJ person. In fact, the whole time I followed the trial, but right. Not really. And I thought he was a quarterback the whole time I did the story. I didn't even know he was a running back. So I was late to the party, you know. I was like catching up on everything. It was an assignment. I was doing my assignment. And I got sucked into the absolute epicenter of it. And when the piece came out, it just exploded like crazy all around the world. I mean, from mainland China to Sweden to just every country imaginable. And they all translated the article. And the whole world was talking about OJ confessed to a journalist in Esquire. And I was then in the awkward position of having to go on television shows and be like a spoiler because I said he did not confess. It was very cryptic, admittedly, but he did not confess to me. And so, you know, there's this OJ tone and like a certain way you're supposed to say everything. And I wasn't hitting those notes. I was just being, I think, a little bit too something like restrained. Because I just felt for a lot of reasons I could talk about or not talk about. It wasn't about whether I thought he was guilty or innocent. I just couldn't. I couldn't strike that right tone, if you know what I
mm-hmm.
mean.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely do. We're talking with Celia Farber. You can check out her Substack at Celia, Celia, Farber.substack.com. Did you communicate with OJ again after that conversation or after the article was published?
Yes, I did. I wound up doing a whole other story connecting with the Inner Circle again, following them to, it was a second story for Rolling Stone, commissioned by the same editor who commissioned me at Esquire, but now he was at Rolling Stone. Esquire had a changing of the guard and all the editors got let go. So I felt indebted to him for giving me this assignment. And so he said, can we do another OJ piece? So we conceived of a new piece and it was called OJ Inc. And in some ways that piece interests me even more than the Esquire piece because it was a lot more nitty gritty detail. And what it was I followed them. There was a subculture hidden black market industry, which was how much money they were able to make off of OJ's signature after the murders. After the murders, his signature became extremely valuable. I don't know if you've ever heard this.
Sure. Well, I mean, and I think one of the arguments that he made in that Nevada case is that he committed that robbery basically to get his own stuff back. And the people, were going to make a whole lot of money from memorabilia, which shows how crazy the whole OJ Inc. was at the time.
Absolutely true. So first of all, let's wind back to in the criminal trial, Mike Gilbert, who features in both of these articles and who really made both of these stories possible for me by giving me so much detail and also bearing his soul and his heart. Unlike OJ, who talks a lot, but Mike was like the tragic, despairing soul of the whole thing. He had just loved OJ since he was a kid, and then he became a client and a friend. And Mike really struggled with trying to hold it together, the OJ myth and his reputation. And I wrote into that, you know, like the inner circle, their anguish, everybody dismissed these people or just as, you know, complicit knife sharpeners. But I thought they were, I thought they were worth really listening to and telling their story. What would you do, you know, if a close friend, client was accused of murder and you wanted to defend this person, but there comes a point when you can't do it anymore, but at the same time, you don't want to throw them under the bus. It's just very complicated. And I'm just the kind of person, I'll always kind of, I think I had, I might, looking back on it all, a failure maybe to be as critical as I could have been, or as, you know, but in any case, in the criminal trial, Mike Gilbert led this mission, which was to sell as much signed OJ memorabilia as humanly possible to pay for the criminal trial, to pay for the Dream Team. So they were signing things 8 hours a day, every day, like 5 days a week. Gilbert would go in there with, you know, decals that they put on the helmets and T-shirts and whatever else. And OJ just signed and signed and signed, photographs, everything. And then they'd cart them out, sell them, and bring in more the next day. I don't know how this never hit the press, but I wound up getting all these weird angles that nobody else had because nobody else wanted to talk to the, you know, very disreputable inner circle. And I did. So I knew that piece. And then for the Rolling Stone piece, Mike brought me along to actually witness this. I forget where we were, somewhere on the West Coast. So I wound up, you know, in this hotel room, seeing all this go down, OJ signing all this stuff. So those were the two pieces, Whistling in the Dark, Esquire, 1998, and OJ Inc., Rolling Stone, 2000. So between those pieces, I wound up spending quite a bit of time with him and his crew in, you know, mostly L.A., but also New York. I also was, for a time, involved in a documentary that was going to happen and didn't wind up happening. So I spent time with him, and it's all in the two pieces. You know, I experienced the OJ phenomenon, his persona, his charm, how he affected people around him. And it was a trip. It was.
So all told, ballpark, how much time would you say that you've spent with OJ Simpson over the years?
You mean like if I said how many?
Yeah, I don't know. How many hours, how many interactions?
Probably I've met him in different situations about 10 times, maybe 30 hours.
And you use the word charming. You would characterize him as a charming person.
Super, super charming. And, you know, the word charm is a complex word, right? It doesn't mean nice. It's not the same as nice. It's charming. It's something that throws people off. But he wasn't just, you know how people say that about Bill Clinton,
right,
who I'm no fan of, but, oh, he was so charming. He was so charming. It's a phenomenon, you know, and OJ was one of those larger than life people. And I'm not addressing good or bad or guilty or innocent. I'm just saying when he walked in a room, everything changed. And I said in the Esquire piece, in chemistry, he would be called a catalytic. And that is a chemical that itself never changes, but changes every other chemical it comes in contact with very dramatically. So he was like that. Like everybody, even people who were trying to be angry or trying to hate him, I saw it. Like they would just change. They would just be won over. Myself included, I really struggled with it. And I put all that in the pieces, you know, with an ambiguous conclusion. Like by the end of it, I didn't even know how I felt about myself or how I wished I had reacted. It was very confusing. It was confusing. But, you know, my job was to put all that into the work.
Sure. Did the folks that you observed him interacting with, his group of friends or acquaintances, did you get the do you have any idea if after his subsequent criminal conviction, the Nevada case, did they stay in OJ's orbit or did he find a new group of people to socialize and play golf with and hang around with?
Both. He mostly found a new group. And I can tell you that I spoke to Mike Gilbert this evening, and he was relaying how he had spoken to Skip. So the inner circle, it was Mike Gilbert. It was Skip Taft. I don't know if you remember that name. Mm-hmm. Kathy Randa. These were like lifelong, you know, inner circle devotees and who works, not devotees, that's totally the wrong word, you know, his core staff. And there had never been any problems before between OJ and these people. So they had very good reason to be loyal to him. And Mike said tonight that before, I think Skip Taft died about a year ago, and that they'd had a conversation. And Skip had said, Mike, do you think OJ would have hung in there like we did? If his reputation was on the line, do you think he would have done any of this for us? And both of them knew, you know, not a chance. So the answer is that the original crew, the core inner circle, they hung on way longer than they wanted to, than was good for them, than was good for their families. Their lives were wrecked, careers, reputation, income, everything. But they held on, and they spoke of, or say Mike spoke of, and speaking for others in that group as well, that they didn't know how to explain why to themselves or to their families. Like, why do we keep defending this guy? And that's a profoundly tragic psychological story about what people generally refer to as narcissism. Right?
The folks that were in his inner circle, that were being asked questions by their friends and family about why they were defending this guy, did you get any sense? You mentioned Mike Gilbert. Mike Gilbert wrote a book essentially with the title of How I Helped OJ Get Away with Murder. Did you get the sense that any of them, including Mike Gilbert, had any moral hesitancy about continuing to be in OJ's orbit if they believed that he was a murderer?
Totally. They were just, Mike always described himself like the way you would sound if you were a, let's say, it doesn't have to be a woman, but a woman who's in an abusive relationship with a man and can't bring herself to leave him. That's like archetypal. That's exactly how Mike sounded. And that's exactly how ashamed of himself he always was. And to this day, he beats himself up relentlessly, and he does not feel that he can ever come out of this self-recrimination and shame. He just is frankly pretty stuck in it. He just feels racked with regret, and he's often trying to apologize to the world and trying to explain it. Now, if I were a playwright, let's say I'm like Arthur Miller, and I'm trying to write about this character, Mike Gilbert, from as sympathetic a point of view as I possibly can, because I think that's more interesting than just bashing people, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to understand people. And I would say, frankly, this is like a love story. Mike loved this guy, And it took him years and years and years. So like the good side of it, if it can be seen as good, is that he was trying to be loyal to his friend who he loved. Don't you run into this in all your mob stories, all your gossip?
Certainly. That's for sure. Hey, right? Celia, we're just about out of time, but I do have to ask you, since you wrote that Observer story 8 years ago about the infamous white Ford Bronco, a lot of folks might wonder, what happened to it? What became of that Bronco after the chase?
Yeah, so real quick. So first of all, there were two Broncos. One was dismantled. The two Broncos, identical. One belonged to O.J. Simpson. The other belonged to his good friend, Al Cowling. It was the Al Cowling's owned white Bronco that was driven that day. Most people think it was OJ's. It was not. It was Al Cowling's who was driving. Some people know that. OJ was in the back. He was suicidal. He had a gun to his head. And this part I never hear told. I'll tell you now. They were driving to Nicole's grave, where OJ had it planned to kill himself at her grave. Did you know that?
Yeah, I had heard that, I think, in the documentary.
Right. And he had, Mike says that he had told Cowlings he did it and he was going to end his life. And Cowlings was, I think, like doing, he was, Mike says Cowlings was always, you know, OJ was dominant. So Al was going to do whatever OJ said. They got there and there was just police everywhere and they're driving around. And then OJ just gets a second thought or thinks better of killing himself. And he says, my mother always said, if you kill yourself, you go to hell. And then he decided to go home.
Hmm.
So he went back to the house and submitted to the arrest.
So very quickly, Celia, that Bronco, the Al Cowlings Bronco, what became of it?
Oh, sorry. I got off track there. Yeah, so the Al Cowlings Bronco was bought by a group of businessmen, one of whom is Mike Gilbert. Cowlings wanted to get rid of it. Mike finally said, look, we'll buy it off you. We'll do it as a business investment. So I think they paid a total of $75,000 split three ways. They bought it, and it's had this absurd afterlife where it now it's at a museum, I think, in Tennessee, a crime museum. It's been in many states, you know, like they put it out and tourists come and they take pictures and selfies. Wow. I think it's even been shipped internationally. Very bizarre. It's
interesting.
So, it's so Americana, you know?
Celia, it's great to talk with you. I appreciate you getting up early. Let's talk again soon.
Love you, Frank.
Thank you. Love you. The great Celia Farber, a daughter of one of my heroes, the great Barry Farber, who I still miss a great deal. If you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, be my guest. 800-848-9222. 800-848-9222. Straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight. Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions have an echo in so much space. And when you're out there without care, yeah, I was out of.
When I woke up in the afternoon, I make my way downstairs and I, you know, chat with my wife for a few minutes. And she says, look, I have just gone through all of, you know, because we're trying to save money. Because you know how it is these days with inflation, especially when you have children. You know, as soon as you get paid, the money's out the door. So she says, I've just gone through all of the streaming networks that we pay for. All the things that we pay for. I don't even think she said streaming. And no, she said, we've gone through everything we've paid for and made a list of things that I'm going to get rid of. And I said, oh, no. She said, don't worry. None of these affect you yet. And I've deleted all my things. Now, I want to go over with you what streaming networks we're paying for and what we can do away with. So, you know, basically she would say, okay, I want to get rid of X, and I'll say, no, we need X so that I can listen to or watch this. And she, you know, we negotiate. This goes on for a little while. And so ultimately, it comes down to we agree to get rid of HBO Max. And I said, okay, do I have a couple of days or is this immediate? Do I get at least one more episode of Bill Maher in before it's gone? She said, nope. The new billing cycle is April 17th. So you have this until April 17th. And I'm curious. Now, I do want to see the Albert Brooks documentary that's on HBO Max. And I think that's where the Bill Bradley documentary is on as well. But if you have any suggestions, seriously, of stuff that's on HBO Max, not shows, but, you know, kind of movies or documentaries or something short form that I absolutely must see over the next 5 days. Let me know, because I want to try and get the most out of our limited HBO Max membership for the next 5 days. Your influence counts. Use it.